Good morning, and let's have the Judiciary Committee come to order. It is 9:45 in the morning of Friday, April 16th, 2010. We have a quorum to conduct business. Senator McGuire is here, Senator Coghill, Senator Wilkowski, myself, Senator French. We have one bill before us this morning, CH for HB 381, Representative Newman's bill dealing with self-defense. Okay. Yesterday we took testimony from the sponsor and from the Department of Law. Didn't get all the way through the Department of Law's presentation. And we took one person from the public who'd been waiting for a long time. I want to get through public testimony, then we'll turn back to some of the legal discussion over the bill. So if we could, why don't we go first to Sitka, where we've got two citizens standing by there. Sitka, if you're on the line, I see John Straley signed up to testify. Mr. Straley, are you there this morning?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
We sure can. Thank you, and good morning. Please put yourself on the record, state your name and affiliation, if any, and then we'd be happy to take your testimony.
Thank you. My name is John Straley, S-T-R-A-L-E-Y. I'm here representing myself. I have been a criminal defense investigator in Alaska since 1984, the first homicide case I worked on was here in Sitka in 1984 as a criminal defense investigator. I'm also a crime writer. I'm the author of 7 crime novels. I was formerly the writer laureate of Alaska, appointed by Governor Murkowski. I would like to speak from my own experience in opposition to the change in the law, in opposition to the bill. I firmly believe that the law as it's written now works. The law as it written now is now, if you look through the packet as I've been doing waiting, the law now protects people in their homes, protects children, protects women and men against sexual assault. And all the law that we have now, it asks that out on the streets, in the parking lots around clubs, in the darkened parking lots around stores and sidewalks, it asks that we pause before we use deadly force, that we pause and step back in these potentially violent confrontations, and that we consider the consequences before we use deadly force. And I think that the law as it's proposed now, I think it is given and proposed in goodwill and by people that are rightfully concerned about safety, but that the law in practice, this change that we're asking to put in the law in practice, is an invitation to gunfighting. I honestly believe that. I've sat with dozens of criminal defendants on their side. I've sat with them in their jail cells after homicides, and the circumstances of the shooting or the killing are all different. But one thing that all unifies virtually all of them is that in the instant that they pulled the trigger or took a life, in the instant that they were doing that, they felt justified. They thought they were shooting or working in some type of criminal defense, and later, it was only later, often only seconds later, when the situation had cooled, the criminal defendants that I've worked with and seen almost always saw that their judgment had been flawed and wrong, and that perhaps often their judgment is clouded by alcohol or drugs, or untreated mental illness, or sometimes a rage that is either justified or not. I don't think that we need to send our citizenry the message that conflict should be more quickly resolved by violence. And I think that's what this law does. It encourages others not to pause, not to consider the consequences of deadly force, but to shoot first in complex situations and then ask the questions later. I think the proposal from the committee is the language, and the reason I wanted to come testify is that the language sounds very reasonable. and it can be seen as a small, really unimportant change. But I think that this little change is like a course correction on a compass. It's just one or two degrees changed, but in time, it will have wide impacts on Alaskan life. And I've given a lot of thought over the years as a writer and as an investigator to the difference between real crime and stories about crime. And the stories are about crime. I wish I knew exactly how to make a bestseller, but I've tried. The stories about crime are often about citizens bypassing the flawed and burdensome justice system to mete out moral vengeance. And if you think about romantic stories and movies, that's really what drives them. That's what it's this instance of taking up arms and the citizen, the clear-eyed, bright, vengeful citizen, you know, meting out moral vengeance. And, you know, and in my stories, I try to make it clear that the good guys and the bad guys are all easily recognized and the good guys win. But this is not a novel that we're crafting here at the legislature. I was sitting talking around the table with the people here at the Legislative Information Office, and what I love about government is something you don't hear very often, but it is that it is slow and it is deliberative, and we pause now to give consideration to the effects of the laws, the words that we put into the laws. And I really believe that the change that we're looking at in this law will increase gun violence. And in a really ironic twist, the change would offer the real bad guys one less hurdle to jump over for the killings that they might want to commit. They will not have the requirement to retreat, to pause and consider the consequences. Now, if we could write a law that said, let's just keep all guns out of the hands of bad guys, you know, that would be something that would be worth considering. But the question of who is a criminal and who is a good guy and a bad guy is not a decision that's made quickly, easily, on the street with under conditions that are often clouded by those things that I mentioned, alcohol, drugs, rage, mental illness. And I've been in writing and investigating crimes for almost 30 years. I know that reality, and this is the one lesson that I've learned over and over again, that reality in Alaska is vastly more complex than our most florid imaginations. The stories that I've seen in real life in Alaska are vastly stranger and weirder than my own novels. And the problems I've seen in real crime in Alaska is not a result of people not shooting enough, but shooting too soon, shooting in which the circumstances were cloudy or unclear. Don't change the existing law as it is now. If you're not inclined to listen to me, and you would have good reason for it. I'm a private investigator and a storyteller. I'm a fiction writer. And I once remember Rick Savodny telling somebody that they thought it was highly appropriate that John Straley was a fiction writer when I was working in the court systems. If you're not inclined to listen to me, listen to your own Department of Law. Listen to people like Rick Savodny and the attorney generals that have written against this law in the packet. This proposal, I honestly believe, gentlemen and ladies, sends the wrong message. It comes from a good intention, but the results will have deadly consequences. We don't need more gunfights. We need fewer. Thank you for allowing me to come before you today.
Mr. Straley, thank you for your excellent and considered testimony. Usually we keep witnesses to 2 to 3 minutes, but we don't have many people, and you bring an interesting perspective. And I'll just say, I think I went to law school with your nephew, Nick Straley, and if you see him, say hello.
I will. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Next up is Kathleen Everest. also there in Sitka. Good morning, Ms. Everest. If you're there, go ahead and put yourself on the record. Oh, no, I see you. Well, do you wish to testify?
No, sir.
Okay, you're just there. You're just there to listen. Very good. I see an N just now next to your name.
Yes.
Next up, why don't we turn now to also on the off nets is Brian Judy. Mr. Judy, you know the drill. If you're on the line, good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Brian Judy. I am the Alaska State Liaison for the National Rifle Association, and I'm representing NRA members today and speaking in support of House Bill 381. The existing Alaska law already provides that there is no duty to retreat if the person's on premises, which the person owns or leases, where the person resides, or in a building where the person works. The intent of this bill is to extend that no duty to retreat to a place where the person has a legal right to be. So under the language of the bill, if you're walking down the street and a rapist tries to drag you into an alley, if you're walking through a parking lot and a kidnapper tries to drag you into the van, you have no duty to retreat. And maybe more importantly, it's one less thing that you're going to have to think about in the split second, life or death decision-making process. And if you choose, you can stand your ground and you can meet force with force. And in the view of the National Rifle Association, this just makes common sense. The Alaska legislature, and this committee in particular, deserves recognition for realizing that Alaskans care strongly about self-defense. Passage of the original concealed weapon permit law in 1994, improvements to the law over the years, and the ultimate repeal in 2003 of the requirement to obtain the permit and essentially governmental permission prior to carrying a concealed weapon for self-defense have been met with great success, quite frankly. Law-abiding citizens are exercising their rights with utmost responsibility. But protecting the right of law-abiding citizens to carry firearms is not enough. Under attack or threat from a violent criminal, a person should not fear prosecution for defending him or herself. Now, I wasn't online yesterday. I was unfortunately unavailable, so I didn't hear the opposition, but I suspect you heard three general points. First of all, that it's already a person already only has to retreat if the person knows with complete safety that they can leave the area. And that is true if you're out in public. You know, it's been explained, if you're in your home, if you're in your business, if you're in your residence, on your property, then you don't have to retreat. But out in the public, if you know with complete safety that you can retreat, then you have to. Now, there are three questions that a person facing a violent threat has to go through in their mind. First of all, they have to determine if they are threatened with certain acts, because there are only certain acts that you can respond to with deadly force, and those are death, serious physical injury, kidnapping, sexual assault, or robbery. So the first thing the person has to decide in that second is if they're faced with one of these outcomes. The second thing they have to determine is if they're justified, if they reasonably believe that deadly force is necessary for self-defense. And then the third thing that has to go through their mind in this split second is, do I know that I can retreat from this area with complete safety? This bill takes that third question off the table, and it does not change in any way the fact that the person has to be justified, that they still have to reasonably believe that deadly force is necessary, and specifically against one of those enumerated offenses or enumerated threats. So, I think that this bill is very reasonable, and secondly on that point is, you know, what's the difference if a person reasonably believes that deadly force is necessary for self-defense against one of these crimes in their home or in their place of work, or when they're out getting into their car in a parking lot, you know, on their way home from work? Why should they have to jump through this additional hoop at that point? Their life is still as important in this other place where they have a legal right to be as it is in these other places. The second thing that I'm sure you've heard is that this bill, in fact, the previous witness just made this point, that this bill is going to contribute to violence. I've heard also that the opposition's calling this the bloodbath bill. Well, this is just the same old, worn-out, unsubstantiated claims that we heard in 1993, quite frankly, when we started running the concealed weapon permit bill. And every time we had a bill to improve on that law, and ultimately in 2003 when Representative Croft carried the bill to do away with it, we heard the same thing. There's going to be blood in the streets. Well, it wasn't true then, and it's not going to be true now. And the third thing that I've heard from the opposition is that we need to err on the side of life, and society should have respect for human life. Well, this same law has been implemented in 16 other states, and we're not seeing any indication that there's a bloodbath. And again, it goes back to that point too. It just has, that claim has never panned out. And one other point that I guess the last point I want to make is on that sanctity of life issue. I have to say the sanctity of life issues are somewhat less compelling in circumstances when the person whose life was taken was doing something, was acting in a way that the person who took that individual's life reasonably feared being raped or killed and was justified in taking that defensive action. A rapist isn't deterred by rape laws, but the hesitation of his law-abiding victim to employ defensive force while she still has a chance, but while she's perhaps sitting there considering a retreat capability, may mean the difference for her between her life and death. So I guess I would point out that the respect for human life and the sanctity of life issue cuts two ways. And in closing, let me just say that Alaska members of the NRA, or on behalf of them, I would like to reiterate that law-abiding citizens should not fear criminal prosecution when they stand their ground and defend themselves from any place that they have a legal right to be. So on behalf of the NRA, I urge your support for House Bill 381. Thank you.
Mr. Judy, thank you. Questions for Mr. Judy? I don't see any. We have Quinlan Snyder on the line to answer questions, and I think the last person signed up to testify is Chuck Kopp, who's here in the room with us. Mr. Kopp, welcome. Put yourself on the record, state your name and affiliation, if any, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Thank you, Senator French. Chuck Kopp, citizen from the city of Kenai. I speak today in strong support of a person's right to self-defense. I agree with many of the comments that the previous speaker made, and I support what I believe is the intent behind what Representative Newman is doing here to help protect innocent citizens. And I know very well that police presence cannot keep all of us safe all the time. And I would argue that most of us don't want that level of police presence in our society. But therefore, we need good laws that will empower citizens to make reasonable decisions with respect to use of non-deadly and deadly force in defense of themselves and others. I have some reservations with what I see may be unintended impacts with the bill as written. The sponsor statement indicates that a purpose of this legislation is to protect an Alaskan citizen from being second judged for using deadly force when they are in any place they legally have a right to be. And secondly, the statement says that this legislation makes it clear that it is criminals that have a duty to retreat. And I would just like to briefly comment on those two points. First, the use of deadly force is a very significant event, often possibly resulting in the death of one or more persons. The action becomes justified under law only after a very thorough investigation in which the defense of justification will either be established according to Alaska Statute Title 11 or not, and the appropriate action taken. If it fails to meet the standard of justification, the action is considered murder, criminally negligent homicide, or manslaughter, and prosecuted accordingly. The law appropriately identifies in Title 11 that the exercise of deadly force to protect oneself applies in all places that you are legally present to seven types of offenses: murder, felony assault, which is serious physical injury, kidnapping, sexual assault, first and second degree, and sexual abuse of a minor. The law clearly says that deadly force is justified if it is used to defend against this clearly identified list of lethal and or very egregious offenses perpetrated against us in our home, place of work, and in any place where we are protecting a family member from those crimes. But the law also recognizes that most uncomfortable, aggressive, or even violent encounters with persons do not rise to the level of using deadly force to protect oneself. The majority of our interactions occur in the course of everyday business, in public places, in grocery stores, parking lots, and roadways, far away from our castles or homes or places of work. These areas are necessarily shared places where all citizens have equal access. And in these areas, a fundamental assumption in our law that is a requisite for peaceful cohabitation is that people show deference to one another and that they yield to one another, turn the other cheek, if you will, for the good of all the people in the shared use of that space. Secondly, to the use of the word criminal in the sponsor statement, when violence does erupt in shared public places, it is often because two persons decided they were not going to yield or defer to one another. And the ensuing investigation has great difficulty in determining who the criminal is in the matter. In traffic, we have yield signs at the beginning of acceleration lanes that merge with the through lanes at the point where the right-of-way becomes less clearly defined. And driver behavior in merge situations could be a doctoral thesis in and of itself on how to yield or the duty to yield as it's exercised by people. But continuing with the traffic analogy, we have a duty to yield to highway construction or traffic workers, to public transit trains and buses, to less maneuverable vessels on waterways, and when driving onto a roadway from non-roadways. And that duty is necessary for all of our safety. The rule of yield is built on the principle of not taking innocent life, foundational to our common law. And we know that to a degree, we must yield and show deference to one another to avoid the unnecessary taking of life. I believe the current law establishes a correct balance between the right to defend oneself and a duty to yield. And I fear that the legislation may have the unintended impact of tipping the balance towards an overzealous use of deadly force, self-defense. Having said that, I recently was presented with a memo from the Department of Law, suggested amendment, which addresses my concerns, and I think it carries forward what the intent of the sponsor is, and I would conclude my testimony with that.
Thank you, Mr. Kopp. I appreciate your testimony coming from a former chief of police. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. Senator Wilkowski.
Mr. Chair, are you referring to the proposed amendment that we have on our desk?
Yes, Senator.
And you support that?
Yes, I do.
Very good. Anyone else online who'd like to testify about HB 381? Oh, I'm sorry.
Is any?
Oh, Sue McLean. Yep. We will get to. Yep. We'll get to her. It wasn't my intention to cut her out, but in fact, why don't we go ahead and? Senator McGuire. Point.
I just wanted to have Annie up at some point.
We will. Actually, we have Sue McLean, who was here yesterday. Who was? Yep. Thank you. And so, why don't we turn to you now, Ms. McLean? You've left Juneau. We're sorry not to have you here, but welcome back to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I just heard that there's an amendment proposed by the Department of Law, and I want to make our position very clear here, which is we're opposed to the law. So that may be some compromise we could arrive at, but we are still opposed to this law. And I think Mr. Straley and Mr. Kopp both said very eloquently what the Department of Law's and specifically the prosecution's problem is with this law. Mr. Judy suggested, as has been suggested throughout the history of this bill as it's worked its way through the legislature, that the purpose of this law is so that a person should not have to fear prosecution for defending himself. And I would start my presentation, I will try to be brief, by saying this, which is what I have not heard throughout all of this is that there is an extraordinarily unacceptable problem with people being prosecuted who have been defending themselves. And the reason for that is because we're aware of our burden of proof. And as Mr. Kopp said, When a homicide or use of deadly force incident is being investigated, we're aware that it is the state's burden of proof in its case in chief, not in response to an affirmative defense. Self-defense is not an affirmative defense. The state has to disprove self-defense. That is, we must prove that a person did not act in self-defense or we face the possibility of a judgment of acquittal. So in those cases where it appears to us that there's a reasonable doubt, the cases aren't filed. And I have some illustrations if the chair if the committee would like to hear them.
I would, yes, thank you.
Okay, I left the committee yesterday. I contacted two offices, Anchorage and Juneau, just because they were easily accessible to me. And I said, you know, you got any recent cases where you have declined to prosecute a case because you saw self-defense? And within 20 minutes, I had six examples. And I will try to go through just a couple of them. One is this. I'll just call our actors here Mr. A and Mr. B. Mr. A is in a public park with a woman. He's, for lack of a better word, coming on to her as it pans out, as the story plays out. He's coming on to the woman. She calls her boyfriend on the cell phone and says, "This guy is harassing me." It's possible that what the boyfriend heard is that he's threatening her. The boyfriend hops in the car, tears over to the park, and runs up to the boyfriend being Mr. Boyfriend, to Mr. A, with a baseball bat in his hand, and he's raising it up above his head as he's running toward, charging toward the boyfriend, or Mr. A. Mr. A has a gun in his waistband, and he pulls it out and shoots the boyfriend. We looked at that and said, you know, we cannot say that we can prove either that Mr. A had started a violent incident and therefore couldn't involve himself in self-defense because it really isn't clear that he was in any way physically threatening the girlfriend, and we cannot prove that Mr. A knew he could retreat. It was a situation that came up quickly. A baseball bat is absolutely a deadly weapon. You get hit in the head with it, you're likely to die, and we didn't charge it. And that's the kind of situation that becomes exacerbated with a law like this. Some other situations that we've seen are situations, Mr. Swobodny had one from Hoonah. Man is found stabbed to death in a ditch. That's all we know. There's no eyewitnesses. The police ask around the community. They learn Mr. A, who is the decedent, was seen arguing with Mr. B earlier in the evening. Please talk to Mr. B. Mr. B says, "We were arguing. He threw his coat over my head. I know he always carries a knife, and therefore I thought he was throwing the coat over to catch me off guard and be able to stab me, so I whipped the coat off my head and I stabbed him." We couldn't take that case. There were no eyewitnesses, and we couldn't prove that what Mr. B was saying was not the truth. We didn't charge him. We didn't charge him. In Juneau just last year, there was a case where police were called because there was a man sitting on the curb. And
Ms. McLean,
go ahead.
That sound you're hearing is not the police. It's a fire alarm. And so,
okay.
Hold on.
It's still going.
I think we're going to recess. We'll recess. Have the Judiciary Committee come back to order after a little break for sunshine and refreshments. We're back on the record. And Sue McLean, you were testifying. We've got the full committee here, or the four of us, which is Senator McGuire, Senator Coghill, Senator Murkowski, myself, Senator French. Ms. McLean, you were on the line. Please proceed.
I was. And Mr. Chairman, I think I neglected to put myself on the record, so I will. I'm Sue McLean, and I'm the director of the Criminal Division of the Department of Law.
Great.
Can you hear me all right?
Yes, we sure can.
All right. I was giving my third example. I have several more, but I'll just leave it at this. The third example of a case where the state did not file any charges because it was our belief that we could not disprove self-defense, or that we could not prove that the person didn't act in self-defense, happened just last year in Juneau. Police were called because a man was sitting on the curb. It appeared that his throat had been sliced. They spoke to that man. We'll call him Mr. A. He says he and Mr. B were inside the apartment building behind him. They were fighting. Mr. A is intoxicated. Police go in the apartment. There's a woman there. She says, I saw Mr. B cutting Mr. A, but I don't know. I was in the bathroom. I don't know what happened before that. I did hear them quarreling, but I don't know what happened. Police talk to Mr. B, and he said, yes, Mr. A and I were fighting. Mr. A tried to strangle me. And I felt that I had to use deadly force to prevent being killed. And that Mr. A is intoxicated. He said, I don't know where my hands were when I was fighting him. So there's a good example of a case where A, we didn't see a duty to retreat, and B, we couldn't disprove the reasonableness of Mr. B's use of force. I mentioned that. I also have provided to the committee, and I hope you got it, a copy of the jury instructions that are typically given in cases where deadly force is used. and there is a use note attached to those. The use note is for the judges and the lawyers to review before the instruction is given. The instruction is clearly states the law as it is right now, that a person may use deadly force unless he knows that he can retreat and that that the retreat duty doesn't apply in those specified circumstances like the home. I think that the use note is helpful, and I'm turning now to page 2 of the use note that follows the jury instruction on deadly force, because it is a communication to the judge and the lawyers saying, look, even if a weak or implausible self-defense claim, it seems incredible, you must give that to the jury if there's any evidence whatsoever of self-defense. But we're talking about cases that are before a jury because they've already gone through a screening process in which the Department of Law has assessed them and has made the decision that there is no reasonable basis to claim self-defense in the case, and we've charged it. So that is an example of why it's troubling to have a bill coming before the legislature, in which it's alleged that we need to protect people from overzealous prosecutors who are prosecuting people who have legitimately acted in self-defense. It's our position that if this bill is passed, it will, amended or not, increase trials. It will absolutely increase trials. And the reason is that the defense is ethically required to raise any plausible defense. So where a defense attorney now might advise his or her client, you shot this guy, and it wasn't reasonable for you to have failed to retreat, and let's just talk about whether there's some resolution we can come to that will save you, some jail time. Now, I think it would be the defense attorney's obligation to advise his client, you didn't have to retreat. So let's go to trial and see what the jury says about it. When Mr. Newman testified yesterday, he testified that reasonable people would not want to kill someone unnecessarily, and we agree. Reasonable people would not want to kill someone unnecessarily. But what this change in the law would do would give unreasonable people the license not to retreat, in other words, to act unreasonable. And I also heard in some of the other committees the argument that, well, in its case, the state could argue that self-defense or that it wasn't necessary to use self-defense because you could have gone behind a door. And therefore, the state can make this argument to the jury that the use of force was not necessary. And that's exactly our point, which is we can't, if the law passes, we can't make that argument to the jury. Because I can play this out and say, we stand up and say, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, it wasn't reasonable for Mr. A to have shot Mr. B. He could have just stepped into the other room. And the defense attorney is going to get an instruction that says he did not have to. So we can't see that it would do anything other than increase trials. There's been a question about how it's played out in other states. As I was saying yesterday, I have read one law review article in from the University of Miami Law Review in 2009. This law, and I refer to it, it's referred to as the Stand Your Ground Law. As Mr. Judy said, it's a new movement. Florida was the first state that had this law, and the author of that law review article quoted an article from the Orlando Sentinel in which the reporter was reporting on the period from October 2005 till June 2006. The law went into effect in October 2005. The report was in June 2006, and the reporter was speaking just of Central Florida, just the Orlando area, and said 13 people have used this defense in response to their use of firearms. That resulted, those cases in which those 13 people were involved resulted in 6 people dead, 4 people wounded. Of those cases, all but one of the people who were killed were not armed. That is, 9 unarmed people were killed in those situations. Of them, 5 were cleared because the prosecution didn't feel that they could prove the case. They couldn't disprove what the defense of didn't have to retreat. 3 were charged in pending trial, and 1 was pending appellate review. So that, I'm sorry, I don't have any better statistics. And as I said yesterday, what we don't know is how this will affect not how the outcome of cases. I think cases that go to trial are much more likely to have the jury find people not guilty, but it will affect us at the outset to say, can we even charge this person? And because it takes away from the prosecution the analysis of saying it simply wasn't reasonable for this person not to retreat when, in fact, we would have a law that says that person didn't need to. So I have nothing further for the committee this morning. I'm certainly open to questions at this point.
Ms. McLean, thank you for your testimony. Questions for Ms. McLean? I don't see any. Why don't we go ahead and have Ms. Carpenetti come up? We do have one conceptual amendment, and I say conceptual because it's in the process of being drafted by Alleged Legal to conform with the language that we'd like to have in our statutes. But this comes to me from the Department of Law, and I'm not sure whether it's you, Ms. Carpenetti, or you, Ms. McLean, that wants to address it, but I just we'll style it amendment number 1. It is by me. I'll move it and object to it, and it's basically the language that most of you have on this memo from me, and the language, I'll just read it, says that at the end of sub 5, you'd add, provided that such person may use deadly force against an intruder or attacker in a place that is not his or her residence without a duty to retreat, only if the person reasonably believes that he or she or another is in imminent danger of death or serious bodily harm from which he or she or another can only be saved by the use of deadly force against the intruder or attacker. And as I say, we're having this drafted by Alleged Legal, but I've moved the amendment, I've objected to it, and let's turn to, is it you, Ms. Carpenetti, or you, Ms. McLean, that wants to give us a little background on this?
Mr. Chairman, I think Ms. McLean knows more about it than I do. I'm happy to address the committee, but I think Ms. McLean knows more about it than I do, so she would be more useful to you.
Thank you. Ms. McLean.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this is Sue McLean again. I think I've made my position really clear, which is that the department is opposed to this law, but if the committee is inclined to pass it, this amendment would make it less objectionable. I think it would do nothing to reduce the number of trials that this change in law would, the increase in the number of trials that this change in law would engender. But what the amendment attempts to do is to say at the least, a person who is outside of, in a place they have a right to be, that the evidence must show that using deadly force was the only way the person could have defended themselves against death or serious physical injury.
Thank you, Ms. McLean. Committee discussion. I'm going to remove my objection to amendment number 1 and ask if there's further objection.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
Only just help me understand the nexus between reasonably believes and only.
And we'll go ahead and line. Let's number these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, with 1 being next to provided, 2 being next to place, and so forth, so we can kind of focus because there might be a couple different onlys. Are you on the only on line?
Only be page, saved.
On line 2, I'm sorry. Retreat only if the person reasonably believes?
It looks like, no, Mr. Chairman. It was actually the last 4? Only on, okay. Yes, I'm sorry.
Line 4. Okay, so seriously about harm, which, you know, there can only be saved by use of deadly force. Ms. McClain, did you follow the question? We're on line 4 of the conceptual amendment where it says can only be saved by the use of deadly force against the intruder or attacker.
Mr. Chairman, can you wait a minute? I don't have a copy with numbered lines.
Okay, I just numbered it myself.
I just need to pull up what's in my computer.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wilkowski.
While we're waiting, the way I read this is it's only if the person reasonably believes, and so I think that reasonably believes applies to the that they can only be saved. So they have to reasonably believe that they can only be saved by the use of deadly force.
All right. And that's
The way I read it.
Right.
That's the way I read it as well.
And that's a clarification I wanted because otherwise you could get two standards in there.
Right. No, and if you've had a chance to look at the packet makes clear that the jury is supposed to consider the reasonableness of a defendant's beliefs must be evaluated by the jury based on the circumstances of the situation facing the defendant, including any relevant knowledge the defendant had about the other person. If you know he's a violent person, if you know he's a person prone to...
Well, that helps, Mr. Chairman. And it looks like if that's the only way out and that's your only reasonable thinking to get out, it seemed clear to me. I just thought maybe we had two onlys in there, and one had a reasonable, and one said that was it exclusive. And reasonably gives reason to get the mental state, but only says without regard to mental state. And so I just wanted to make sure.
Good discussion and good clarification. Further committee discussion. Senator Wilkowski.
Mr. Chair. And maybe law can help out here. The reasonably believes, is that an objective standard or a subjective standard? In other words,
Ms. McClain, you want to jump on that?
Sure, I can. Reasonable is always an objective standard. Well, there are always two standards in self-defense. First of all, the defendant, the accused person, has to actually believe it. So there has to be an actual subjective belief. There has to be proof of that. And secondly, it has to be a belief subjectively that society is willing to regard as reasonable, that the jury is willing to regard as reasonable. Right?
Let me go ahead, and I'm just going to go ahead and read this part again because I think it is relevant to Senator Wilkowski's question. The reasonableness of a defendant's beliefs must be evaluated by the jury based on the circumstances of the situation facing the defendant, including any relevant knowledge the defendant had about the other person, physical attributes of all persons involved, in any, including the defendant, and prior experiences that could provide a reasonable basis for the defendant's beliefs. So it's somewhat subjective, that is, look at it through the eyes of the defendant. However, as Ms. McClain pointed out, reasonable belief means that a reasonable person would have held such a belief under the same circumstances. And then finally it says a defendant's distorted perceptions due to mental illness, however, may not be a factor in evaluating the reasonableness of the defendant's beliefs. Does that help?
That's helpful. Thank you.
Further committee discussion on Amendment Number 1?
And Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill, sorry.
We do look a lot alike.
Hey, Senator Wagner.
So I see now that one is believes in imminent danger, and that's the only way out. So then the only way out is going to be the part that people are going to have to look at. So,
and I guess I'll just remind folks that, again, it's the prosecution who's going to have to disprove all this beyond a reasonable doubt. It's not the defendant who has to say, you know, has to prove it was reasonable. The prosecution's going to have to say that was not reasonable. Okay. Senator McGuire.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, I can't remember if either person from the Department of Law, how is intoxication treated, either, you know, mind-altering drugs or alcohol? How is that treated?
Ms. McClain.
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, intoxication is not a defense to a criminal act on unless what is charged is an intentional criminal act, which in the case of homicide is first-degree murder, that is with a specific intent to kill, and then the jury can consider it as how it impacted the defendant's ability to form an intent.
And how does it play out? I mean, Senator McGuire's question is interesting. I just can't remember. How does it play out in a self-defense claim? You know, one person's drunk, the other person's sober. I think you gave us facts where we had an intoxicated person in example number three. We didn't cover it in example number one. Example number two, I can't remember if there's intoxication. What does a jury do with a reasonableness standard with an intoxicated defendant?
I think you would find 100 cases on that point, Mr. Chairman. But
are you saying that alcohol is often involved in slayings in the state of Alaska?
Mr. Chairman, I think that if what is charged is the crime of first-degree murder, then the issue of the defendant's intoxication is going to go both to his ability to form an intent to kill, and it's going to be interwoven with whether or not he reasonably believed he had to use self-defense. But basically, if the person is the jury is going to hear the evidence of intoxication, and from court to court, it will differ about how they get instructed, I think, about how that impacted what the defendant reasonably believed he had to do in self-defense. I think you would find courts that would say, "I'm not required because it's I'm not required to give a specific instruction on how the intoxication affected his mental state with respect to the crime, with respect to whether or not he thought he had to act in self-defense." I'm going to use a word here that's going to really confuse it. What you're talking about is what we call kind of a diminished capacity, that is, in the status of that defense is always up in the air in Alaska. I'm sorry, I cannot be any more precise with you. I will say this. If self-defense is raised, the jury's going to hear everything.
Senator McGuire.
And thank you. And to the chair, I'm going to support the bill, but I appreciate Brian Judy's testimony and the bill's sponsor and the sentiment of the bill. And Alaska has these high rates of alcohol involved violence, and it just troubles me. And I like the new language, and I would just really, we just have to watch these situations where, if it does involve a cultural shift, and it can go both ways. The cultural shift on the one hand is a benefit to individuals who want to be safe and don't want to have to retreat and want to be able to go and live their lives safely and not have a fear of rape and murder. And I understand that, but the cultural shift goes the other way. In that, especially trickling down to young people, and I'm thinking particularly about the young people in my district in the Diamond Center area lately, who there's been a cultural shift, and people are just bringing out guns instead of, the good old-fashioned fistfight anymore. And I get concerned that cultural shift gets so embedded, and people are then under the influence of alcohol, and out comes the gun, and it seems reasonable because they are under a mind altering substance, and then somebody's dead, and it doesn't really matter anymore. I mean, you can sit there and talk about what was reasonable or not, but that life is gone. And I just want those comments on the record. I'm going to support the bill, and the note here to me is it's not legal to carry a weapon when you're intoxicated, and that's right. And there is a provision under the full Title 11 that talks about gang members and those kinds of things. But again, I caution us on the cultural shift and how that gets interpreted.
Good remarks. Thank you, Senator McGuire. Further discussion on Amendment Number 1? Further, any objection to Amendment Number 1? Hearing and seeing none, Amendment Number 1 is adopted. here's my plan. This language is working its way through Jerry Luckup. I want to see the language. When it comes back, we'll make sure it comports with what we believe we adopted, and then we'll take final action on the bill. With that, we are in recess. We'll call the chair.